And mahalo for listening to Kauai Community Radio. This is Kauai Soapbox. So, we do have a few upcoming events. We have Waimea Days, and I'm really happy to announce that. That's going to be next week, and you can look it up online. There's so many different days, so many good things going on. KKCR, Kauai Community Radio, we're even thinking about trying to have a booth out there to get more participants from that side to feel involved. We've been really honored to have the commander from the base on. Today we'll have Syngenta. And next week we're going to have people from Kauai Veterans Memorial Hospital. So that'll be three shows in a really close time period that are from there. On the 17th of this month, which is a week from Wednesday, KKCR will be doing a live broadcast of the KIUC Forum. If people would like to go and see the candidates for the election that's going to be beginning, I think on the 15th, that's coming up, they could go to Chiefess Kamakahele School at 5:30 on Wednesday, or you could tune in to KKCR. Kauai Veterans Memorial Hospital, by the way, they are running out of funding, or I'm exaggerating, but they need money. Let me put it that way. They need help from the state, and there will be a demonstration this Friday morning from 7 to 8, and then in the afternoon around 4 o'clock. We'll probably be hearing from one of them at the very late part of this show. Kauai Farmers Union United is meeting tomorrow night. There will be some training on being able to handle how to work with capital.hawaii.gov. One really great thing of being a part of the state of Hawaii is that it's actually an easy way to be able to communicate with the government if you're right on it, but you have to be right on it. And I feel like it's something close to the stock market, how much it changes, you know, from moment to moment. It is a fast-paced thing that's going on there. Because I really follow the seed and plant exchange March 13th, Sunday afternoon, we will be doing that. But for those of you who are making extra effort to give plants for that, it's time to start germinating them. People really love to get that. Marshall, I know the New Hampshire caucus was today. Did you pay attention?
I did. That's the primary.
The primary. All right. So, and the winner is?
Well, on the Democratic side, we've got, Sanders. Bernie Sanders has won with 57.7% of the vote. Hillary Clinton has 40.4%, and 0.2% actually voted for Martin O'Malley, who dropped out of the race.
Okay, and now is that the final? Is everything counted? That's a significant lead. I know we were expecting a lead for Bernie Sanders because it says next door neighbor state, but that's kind of a big deal.
That was just updated now. Actually, right now, and so that's 9 o'clock in New Hampshire. I would assume the polls are closed or closing, and they've got enough of the results that they're pretty confident in those numbers.
With a 17-point lead, I'd say that's very significant. Stephen, do you have something to say on that? You're smiling.
Let's just put it this way: that over time, truth always prevails.
Yeah, well, so that was that's a big lead. And how about for the Republican primary? Or is it caucus or primary for the Republicans?
Primary as well.
Okay, which means they vote for all the different seat holders there, not just one position.
They vote for... I'm sorry.
Okay, neither one of us know. Okay, but so what was the outcome for the Republican?
33.9% for Donald Trump.
So Donald Trump was the winner. So that's interesting. I mean, that shows the range that we have when we have two of the outliers, that's the don't trust the government crowd, I would say, you know, that those are the outliers.
Yeah, even though Bernie Sanders has been a senator and pretty much in political office for much of his life.
And consistent in his positions.
Yes, yes. And so sort of definitely outside of the mainstream in his views of presenting the, you know, whatever alternative there is to the standard politics on the left, for sure. But, right, the electorate wants something else, something new and different. And
so Ted Cruz was, I mean, excuse me, Donald Trump, number one at 34%. Still, that's not even close to the 57% that Bernie got, but 34%. And then who was next?
John Kasich actually had 15.3% of the vote. So,
you know, he's number two?
Yeah, far behind, but he wasn't a name that, you know, you even heard associated with Iowa caucuses. And apparently he had a really great ground game. A number of candidates were counting on New Hampshire as their breakout race. Ted Cruz did stick in there to get third at 11.6%, and Marco Rubio had 10.4%. You know, Donald Trump won 9 delegates, and none of the other candidates won any. So, you know, they have their percentages of the vote that they got, but basically Trump ran the board.
Okay, so if you look at the Democrat, how much is the delegate split there?
Let's see. We've got 13 delegates for Bernie Sanders and 7 for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, so it wasn't just a broad sweep on that. And can you tell if there's a number of voters? Is New Hampshire dominantly a Democrat state or dominantly a Republican state?
It's dominantly Democrat.
We would call that a blue state.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So does Felicia know those things? Yes, but trying to make sure that we're really clear and double-checking. So the Hawaii caucus events, those are coming up, and one of these shows, either March 1st or March 8th, I'll probably make it March 1st. We're going to do a little bit of political training in here so people understand if they want to participate in the caucuses, where they go for both the Republican and for the Democrat. And the Republican caucus is going to be on March 8th. Pausing because I'm double checking, but I did post that today. It's March 8th, and then the Democrat caucus is March 26th. And so we will be talking about that. And I have had a strong request from listeners for us to give people a good idea and a good background of how to use capital.hawaii.gov. Mm. And so I am going to listen to the listeners and work on what they've asked for. So, in speaking about listening to the listeners, and a lot of this show is actually fed on Facebook and social media, but phone calls, emails, and so Sheila Young had actually caught my attention. You are an animal care provider. Is that correct? How would you call yourself? What would you say that you are? You're an animal activist, but you're also an animal health activist.
I'm very eclectic. I do it all. I stand up for animals and
speak into the microphone.
Okay, I stand up for animals and I help them with health issues, mostly their skin. I do rescue, I do shows, I do it all. And so, but basically I don't want to be an activist because to me that comes from anger. I'd rather be an advocate.
Okay, advocate.
Yeah, it's softer. And but anyway, what I've been doing is lately, the past year or so, I started picking up consultations, and I do things holistically. I look at each animal individually and what caused their skin issues. And so while I was visiting with some hunter friends of mine, one hunter came and I was introduced to him, and he said he had 4 dogs that had such bad skin stuff that he was going to put him down. So one of the other hunters said, well, you should try this girl's stuff. So I made an appointment with him, and I went out there, and I came upon 4 Airedale puppies that were in a cage off by themselves, and they all had hair loss to the point where they didn't have any fur at all, and crusty skin and blah, 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 blah. So I looked at it, and I have only seen that really to that severe one other time, but I thought it was mite. So I said, whatever it is, this stuff will help. So I gave it to him. He called me a week later, said, I can't believe it, but they've gotten better. I want you to see a friend of mine who has 6 puppies with the same condition in Wailua. So I went, you're kidding me. I mean, this is weird. So I went out there. I asked him if he had a vet look at it, and he said, no, he didn't. He had tried all of his normal things. Then I went to the other hunter, and the same thing, 6 dogs with the same thing, only he said he had a vet look at it, and it was mites from the mother's milk. So I gave him the product. It responded. Then next thing I know, I started having some alarm go off in me that something wasn't making sense in these consultations, and I couldn't figure it out. About that time, Dr. Stephen Blake started posting vaccination information, and I started seeing it mostly pertaining to humans, but then I did see a couple of them pertaining to animals. And when I read the symptoms of what causes skin stuff, a lot of those symptoms were in these dogs that I was dealing with. So immediately I called these hunters up and I said, let me ask you a question. Before these dogs, you know, what were you doing before? Did these dogs have this skin problem from the time they were born? No, they were in perfect condition. I go, what changed? They vaccinated them. 2 weeks after vaccination is when the skin stuff started, they told me. I said, okay, bingo. I called the next hunter. Same question. Same thing with that hunter. 2 weeks after vaccinations is when the skin stuff started. Then I went back over my notes over several clients that I had that said their dogs had never had skin problems until they moved here. They were on great diets. They were doing everything right. And then I went back to that time zone, and I said, okay, what was going on? Well, we moved here. They had the normal vaccination shots. 2 weeks after those vaccination shots is when they started showing skin stuff. Bingo again. Then on top of it, they started adding the flea stuff and all this other stuff, and their dogs were just going downhill. So I came in and did my thing, removed all the toxic stuff, put my products on them. They all got better. But bottom line is the root cause is vaccines.
Or at least that's what you were seeing as a pattern. So
yes,
I saw that, and then you made a post that Dr. Stephen Blake, who is in the room here with us, he was coming, and that you had wanted to bring him on the air. And I thought, oh, okay. And then I like to always go and learn more about whoever the guest is if I possibly can. So I went through his ABCs of natural health care for animals. I might have that not quite right. Okay, you said that's right. So I went there, and I will say that 2.5 hours flew by with so much quality information. I could have listened for another 3. And I liked, just like our Pets in Paradise show on Saturday, which is a holistic health care for animals, that, you know, you can listen through it to what is important for humans. So I'm pretty excited to have you on the show here today, Stephen. Can I call you that? Or Steve, what do you go by?
I go by many names.
Dr. Blake.
Dr. Blake, Doc, Stephen, Josh,
okay.
Key, I have many names.
Okay, so you know, our listener is largely human. Plenty of who have animals. But so when I'm wanting to hear from you, you know, I understand that you're a vet, and I want to have part of the message as it pertains to animals, but also, like, as much as you can, that we're really looking at both human-animal as well as our furry four-legged friends, because so much of what you had to say really relates to what we're dealing with. And this is also important because right now we have 7 bills before the legislature. Well, one of them now has been sundown, and that happened last Wednesday. Last Tuesday, we were talking about it. That was the human papillomavirus vaccine. They wanted to make that mandatory for all, you know, boys and girls as they enter school at middle school. And there's pressure nationally to make mandatory vaccination. Some of these bills are simply to mirror what the U.S. government says. So then we have not only control at our schools or in our families, but with the U.S. And it can be nerve-wracking to see what they decide is important. Like, yes, I understand that people have had, we have seen success, and we could argue it, but there are certainly people who believe, and there is some, if you look at graphs, there's success with what happened after the polio vaccination started. There, you know, polio drops, smallpox dropped, we see that. But I know, like, as a parent, when, you know, they expect you, they don't even hardly give you an option. They give your kid a hepatitis B vaccination on day one. And you think about it, you get that from IV drug use or sexually transmitted disease. So that's, you know, being really proactive to do something like that on day one. So those are some of the concerns that many people have. So I'm just framing that out a little bit about vaccinations. I'm not trying to tie you to the vaccination discussion because you had a whole swath of what was important when we're looking at avoidance and then building your health and certainly cleansing your life and your environment of what is unhealthy. I'm about to let you just really roll with this for a while. I want to also say that your credibility from when I began talking to you or listening to you went really high for me because you're almost 70. Is it okay if I tell people that? He's nodding his head. He's almost 70, but you have the posture and weight and body design of a young man. You do some extreme athletics in endurance, and your skin looks younger than mine. So you're doing something right. So with that, I don't want to over-guide you. I might interrupt because you have a robust vocabulary, so if I jump in and soften up a word that might not be clear, I did a little vocabulary development yesterday. Dr. Steve Blake, please share with us what we would say is your knowledge.
Aloha.
Aloha.
And mahalo. Yeah, before I begin, I really want to thank everybody for taking the time out of their day to participate in this sharing event in the universe, because this is going out everywhere. And also, I want everyone to give a big aloha to your government, who shot down the first bill of 7. We went through it in California, and flew right through because it was all paid for. So we had thousands of people protesting. It didn't matter. It went through. It's been already mandated for children in our state to be vaccinated, which is...
With everything.
All the CDC stuff.
Center for Disease Control.
Yeah. And they're just going with the CDC's, you know, list of arbitrary vaccines they've come up with.
And California came out first, and this round there are many states that are being faced with it. California was the experiment state. They made it through there. Then they're trying to do the avalanche, the waterfall behind it of... To me, compliance, and I'm just going to throw a little bit of my personal perspective in here, I consider mandatory anything, particularly mandatory vaccination, fascism.
Well, it's unconstitutional to begin with, because it takes away our right of choice. I'm sure our forefathers are rolling over in their grave listening to this conversation. But anyway, what I was going to say, going back to the start, because what I was going to say is everyone needs to give a big aloha mahalo to your congresspeople, because there's 7 more coming. The amount of money...
6.
6, whatever. There'll be another one. If there's 6, there'll be 7, there'll be 8. They're doing it in every state. Texas shot it down on the first go-round, Oregon shot it down, but most of them are going to go along with it. And that's what I'm afraid of, because there's so much money involved. There's no science behind it. It's just a theory. How I got into all this is I've been in the medical field now, counting veterinary medical school, 47-plus years. I've always wanted to be a doctor, so I've been exploring medicine since I was born, 6 years of age. So I've got almost... 64 years of experimenting on the life of my life in medicine. When I went to veterinary school at Colorado State University, I really want to make it clear. You guys need to contact your congressman. If you go on Facebook, you can befriend me or Sheila or any of us, and I post every day. I drive people crazy. I post so much stuff on vaccines. But it'll help you to know what you need to do. You need to contact these people.
And we are always very careful to not do a call to action. But if people would like to contact their congresspeople, one way is you can do it collectively, or you can look on capital.hawaii.gov, and you can see who does what pieces. But the general location to communicate with everybody is you'd go sends, as in senators, at capital.hawaii.gov, or reps, as in representatives.
Can I ask a question to Dr. Blake?
Yes. You
know, this, my main concern is animals, but my question is, how does this, I mean, how can animals stand up and say this is against their rights to not have mandatory vaccinations, say, for example, when they come across to Hawaii from the mainland? They all have to have mandatory vaccinations, or they cannot come on the islands. You know, that, how are the laws going to pertain to protecting the animals from having to have these mandatory vaccinations? You know, politically, yeah, we're covered on the human side of things, but how are we going to handle this for the animal side? That's my concern.
Well, I could answer that, because it's a state thing, and I wouldn't think that he would know that. That is already a law, and they have been softening the laws. It was a very long
quarantine,
and one of the reasons, honestly, is because we have too many animals here. So they were trying to slow down it, but then we would end up with animals who had psychological problems when they've been sitting basically in jail for 3 months on a different island or whatever amount it was. But it would take you speaking to your legislator and putting in a bill, and it's not that it couldn't be done. It would need to go real broadly, and it's probably a hard sell because animals are almost considered property and not sentient beings.
Well, I'll see what I can do.
So that would be how you would do it.
Mm-hmm. So to clarify that, when you say mandatory vaccines for animals, there's only one. It's always been one. It's rabies. It's the only communicable disease that's required mandatory by law in every state. Some states, if they're not vaccinated and they bite someone, they chop their head off right then. That's their law. Each state has its own requirements, but the only mandated vaccines in the United States are rabies. It's been like that for decades. The problem is there's no science behind it. Just vaccinating every year, there's actually no science behind that. It's just something the drug companies came up with. So if you're going to do it, if you're going to mandate rabies to prevent prevention of rabies, then they really just, if you're going to do it, and it's just one shot and you're good for the go. So anyway, the animal thing is really, I mean, that's my deal, but the way I got into it, I was trained in vaccines and everything that any medical doctor was trained in, because we're trained the same way, except I have 5 species to learn, and they only have to learn one. So in that learning, I was taught the same way. Well, then when I got out of school, I started doing what I was trained, and then over a period of time, I had some medical issues that were caused by the chemicals I was putting on the animals, and that got me into being a holistic veterinarian out of necessity. You can read that on my website. Well, then that, when there's an old Chinese proverb about when the student's ready, the teacher appears. Man, they came out of the woods, from out of the sky, out of the ground, because I needed to learn this stuff. The problem was there was no animal sources for teaching, no homeopathy for animals, no herbal teachings, no Reiki, nothing. Everything was in humans. So I went to the human literature, and that's how I discovered vaccinosis. I'd never even heard the word.
So tell us that, yes.
So vaccinosis is out of the homeopathic literature, and basically what they're saying is a disease caused by vaccines. So I'd never heard that, because I was always taught that vaccines are safe and, you know, no worries, are very effective and blah, blah, blah. So once I read all the symptoms of vaccinosis, I realized that they were all the symptoms I see coming back all the time, no matter what I did. And then I saw that the common denominator was vaccines. So I studied the human model in great detail, and I really, that's where I got all my knowledge from. So when you're talking about humans and animals, they're the same. As a matter of fact, they experiment on the animals before they experiment on the people, which I'm appalled at that. I mean, if you want to, somebody's willing to let them jab them and stuff like that one doctor that says 10,000 vaccines are safe, they had had vaccine MD, I want him to come on TV, maybe QVC or something, because he could probably sell some vaccines while he's doing it, inject himself 10,000 times. Well, that's where that's coming from. But it's totally unsafe. It's bizarre to, in the first place. So anyway, the point of vaccinosis is when I read what it was, it explained why I was having so much difficulty, just like what Sheila, when she saw what I had posted. I've been at this for over 35 years, so I've been studying this for a long, long time. But I used the human literature to guide me into how I could help the animals. So that's what I've been doing, is translating human literature into animals, and my animals don't know placebo. So they're getting better, not because of some, because sometimes they'll say, oh, it was spontaneous remission or it was placebo effect. Well, that's not how animals work. It either helps them or it doesn't help them. So that's how I got into it in the beginning. But it's all based on human literature. Whatever I say about animals, it's coming from the human side.
So that's great. And you're listening to Dr. Stephen Blake. He and Sheila Young are in the studio with me on Kauai's Soapbox. This is Felicia and Marshall at KKCR, Hanalei KAQA Kilauea.
So, again, what I was saying about the vaccines is that it's like everything else. If you hear something long enough and repeat it often enough, slowly over time to the masses, pretty soon anyone who's trying to speak the truth sounds like a raving maniac. I paraphrase that from a quote. And that's what happens, is you keep telling everybody, I'm going to use this phrase again. I know Felicia wasn't so sold on my comment yesterday, but I'm going to make sure everyone understands what I'm saying, that for 2,000 years in Europe, on the European continent, flat earth maps were sold very effectively. However, my audience here in Kauai are from Polynesian. Polynesian didn't buy it. They got in their canoes and took off, and they didn't listen to these crazy people in Europe. But the crazy people in Europe believed it for 2,000 years, even though the Greeks, the Mayans, everyone else knew it was around. My point of saying that is that's where vaccines fall in. We've been saying over and over they've saved the world. They're the only way to prevent it in medicine. You just keep saying that long enough, and everyone believes it, to the point where they'll actually turn in their brother and sister or call them anti-vaxxers, and you can't be with my children, because I've witnessed all. It's going all over the place. And so they're labeling them as not safe people to be around, just like they did during Nazi Germany. It's the same technique. So my point is that just because something's been done by the general public, the majority, doesn't make it truth. It's just been accepted as the general belief system. And so with vaccines, it's very emotional. I mean, really, I know a lot because I have a lot of experience. And I can cite all kinds of studies, and I can refer you to all kinds of things. But it's just so emotional that if I say anything, if I say, well, let's talk about vaccines. Well, you know, if you're not vaccinated, you're not protected, you're going to affect my child, herd health, and all this stuff starts spewing out. You know, and they have no medical training. They're just talking.
So when you were giving the class, you did this ABCs, and so you spoke about avoidance. And I noticed, you know, most people in the room were kind of smiling, you know, and they're listening at these common sense elements of, like, you know, what you do with your dog. And I was really kind of going, you know, in terms of the empathic element for the dog to their human partner, their human pet. But when you were speaking about avoidance, maybe you can talk to that for a moment, like, in how does one create good health when we have avoidance building and cleansing? Because I think that that's a really important piece that, you know, probably, you know, not all of us live in the best of health practices, so we are susceptible to these things.
Yes, and when what I was speaking to, and you can, a lot of this is on my website, thepetwhisperer.com. It's a free site to help educate people.
And that starts with the.
The.
T-H-E. Pet Whisperer.
The.
Yeah.
anyway, so what I discovered early on in my practice was that what I was taught under reductionism, which reductionism is Western medicine, the idea of getting rid of a symptom.
Reducing illness to symptom and solution, right?
Yeah,
that's where we
name,
go reductive.
Yeah,
reductionism is reducing.
It's reducing Western a medicine. Symptom, and that's considered cure or curative. That's how that system works. And I'm trained. I could sell you every aspect of it because I did it for many years. And it has a place, but I'm just saying, this is where our training comes from. So back to the A word, which I told you is avoidance, is the problem with Western medicine is we don't look at why, we just look at what can we do to get rid of it. So why is the dog sick? Not what is wrong with it. What's the name? The difference is, why is it sick? No. What is the diagnosis and what is the treatment? That's what you're taught in reductionism. Basically. So you spend a lot of time, a lot of tests coming up with a Latin word. It's fine. I spend a lot of time memorizing those things, and I'm glad I know them, and they play a part. However, it doesn't get to the why. It's just saying, you might say, oh, he's allergic to strawberries. Well, why? Then that's the end of it. So don't give me strawberries. That's reductionism. I would say, why? Why is he allergic to strawberries? You know, what's wrong? But that's the difference. So went back to avoidance. So I gave an example yesterday of one of my early cases where the dog would throw up every month. So we went to many veterinarians. No one could figure it out. They come to me. I take the history. I ask them, okay, when does the dog throw up? End of the month. What do you do at the end of the month? I ask them all kinds of questions. Same thing I do every other day. What do you do? What do you do? I say, does someone else do something on the end of the month? He says, yeah, the pest guy comes by and sprays my yard and my house. I said, every month he does that, or she, whatever. He said, yes. And I said, well, when does he throw up? And she got real quiet, and she goes, after he leaves. And I said, what did they tell you? Wait an hour. This is what they all tell you. Wait an hour, and then it'll be safe to let your dog out. Well, I don't know what magic thing happens in 60 minutes, but that dog goes out and walks in the yard and licks his feet, and then he got sick. So all they did is say, fire the what I won't say the name of it. They fire the pest truck and use that money for better food for your dog because what you're feeding is not what I would feed anything. And so they stopped that, and there was no treatment. So I went to the why, and then, of course, I went into all the other things that I talked about yesterday about, you know, the using chemical herbicides in your yard, everything. I nail them down on every little detail, cleaning things, even TV. I told you yesterday I don't want to watch any toxic TV. So I go down the whole list, and if you're toxic, quit being toxic around my dog. You know, get zen, and then go back and talk to the dog.
Right, and we can see children and pets, and really adults are just better at masking it. If they're around an argument or a stressful situation, then they're going to pick it up. And I was smiling when you were talking about that because I was thinking, well, you know, actually, and since I've been doing this radio show, you know, definitely more than before, my life becomes about looking at people's concerns and helping them explore them. And it can honestly be a little stressful. It's definitely a big learning environment, and I'm grateful for it. But if I wasn't looking at what was wrong, I wouldn't be able to be looking at what are solutions. So there's, you know, there's a little bit of a balance in there of where do you do it, or I guess you don't look at it around your dog or yourself.
Yeah. No, I'm agreeing with you. Remember what I said yesterday? You have to be very mindful about, and it's really more of a Zen Buddhist way of looking at things. But it, because you're a microcosm, your dog, your cat, your horse, your pig, you, your husband, your children, you're all a microcosm, and you all affect each other. So if you're not, that's why when I got into this, I realized this is bigger than the dog. I mean, the dog's just the messenger, or the cat or the horse. They're the messenger coming forward to connect us. They're the path walkers. They connect us for source, to spirit. So they're trying to wake us up, and then if we're not waking up, they're not judging us, but they're really, it's frustrating.
And you have this book, it says, Story About My Friends, The Animals, and you've got a bunch of little stories in here, and it's a simple, easy read, but one story you shared was about Old Joe.
Oh, yes, Old Joe.
You can't really animate it physically the way that you did, but maybe you could, you know, give us a short version of Old Joe.
Yeah, well, James Herriot, a famous Scottish veterinarian back in the 80s, I fell in love with him and his writings, and so I told myself someday I would write a book similar to his, but from my perspective instead of the Highlands of Scotland. So in 2003, I wrote this book. I wrote it while I was driving my car with my wife across New Zealand, and I just came with stories in my head that I'd had, and this is one of them. I called it Old Joe, and Old Joe was a new client, came in, an older gentleman in his 80s, and a dog that would be comparable to 110. And they ambled into the room very slowly, and we talked, and he was brought the dog to be euthanized. And so I asked him, I said, well, why are you euthanizing the dog? And he said, well, because he's so old, and I don't like to see him suffer. And I said, well, let's try something different. Now, you're Joe. And now Joe's sitting in the chair, and you just said that. How would you feel if your best friend said, you're getting old, and it's time to be euthanized? We're being kind with the word killed. And so he looked at me, and he didn't say anything, but he winked. And he says, I get it. And so he decided not to euthanize Joe. So I treated him, and I said, come back in a month. And I gave him some things to do. He came back in a month. They both came across the room much quicker than the time before. And we talked, and he said, Joe's glad that I didn't do what I came here for. Joe lived another 5 years, and then he each time would come back once in a while. After a while, after I taught him what to do, I didn't see much, but he was coming in buying all kinds of stuff that he didn't need because his little dog was tiny, but he was consuming copious amounts of what I was sending out, which was just nutritional supplements. So I got him in the room, and I said, I would just call him Old Joe. And I said, why are you going, what are you doing with these things? Because are you giving all of this to Old Joe? And he goes, oh, I got to tell you, Doc, I've been taking them too. And because he knew that I told him everything I use in my practice has been tested thoroughly on humans, not animals. And if they don't start squawking about something and it doesn't kill them, then it's safe to use on animals. So everything I used on him was intended for humans. So he was taking the remedies, and he said he hadn't felt that good in 30 years. So that went on for 5 years, and then one day it was time, and then in the story it tells you what happened.
And the book is called The Pet Whisperer, and the subtitle is Story About My Friends, the Animals.
Yeah, it's on my website. It's not in a bookstore. It's self-published, and I just have it on my website.
So I want to suggest to you that you need a little bit of help on your website. I was trying to find I was so bound and determined to read what you had to say. Mindful healing. And I couldn't find it on
really?
The website.
You put it in the search box?
I put it in the search box.
Wow, under categories?
I did too.
And,
wow.
And she couldn't find it either. And,
okay. Well, I'll ask my webmaster about that because I don't have anything.
Because when
that.
I was done with your workshop, and I'll be honest, I go to so many workshops and I appreciate them, but I have a certain amount of skepticism and I have a certain amount of busyness in my own head because it just can't do everything. And when I was done listening to you, I thought, I got to read that, and I want to make those differences, and I'm happy to have Sheila come guide me with my dog. And without going into details, you answered good questions about how we, you know, avoid or push away heartworm and fleas.
And lepto, too.
And lepto. And we didn't talk about that one, but that's one that we could talk about. And talking about having, you know, resilient immune systems. And that was really meaningful to me when I was participating in a lot of these concerns about the pesticides. And I'll be honest on that one, too. I'm late to the ball on that one. I only got involved because of a lot of concerns from the other side. And March of, I think, 2014, I might have that year wrong, I think it was 2013, the State Department of Health did what's called a snapshot of all the streams, not all the streams, many streams, a collection of streams across all the islands. And some of them were right near the biotech fields, other were in towns, there was ones on the North Shore here. They really went for a random assortment, and 100% showed pesticides in the water. And some of the most toxic contaminants in the water anywhere were in the cities, were in the urban areas. Certainly Niamalu area in Lihue was really, really strong. And the number one toxin was the flea medication. And so something I'm really sensitive to is not being a hypocrite, doing my very best to not be a hypocrite. When we ask other people to give up something they believe that they need, we need to really check ourselves and see where are we adding. And I haven't been a big one with the flea medication because I had smaller dogs too, and they tend to throw up and shiver. you know, have a little bit shakes when I put that on because they were on the smaller end and, you know, you're estimating when you're putting it on. So I wasn't strong at doing that, but I noticed my cats don't get them. My dog does. You know, some animals do, some don't. And so it was really meaningful to me. And I'm actually going to experiment. I'm going to rope Sheila in too, and I know that you're willing, but I want to see how I can help my dog really be flea free without the use of a collar or some sort of chemical.
Yeah, but remember what I told you, that's how I got into it. Pesticides were killing me.
Yes.
That's how I got into it.
Yes.
So I had to give up everything, all the things that made me money.
Let's talk about that for a moment. I will say, you know, we lost we have a number of vets, but we were very, very attached to Scott Sims, who was really amazing and a selfless man and saw the animals at midnight. And but he was, I would call, an allopathic doctor. Our Pets in Paradise doctor, Dr. Ihor Basco, is more of a holistic doctor. But Scott, I would say to him, you know, I don't want you to die of cancer, because I would see him just be so fearless with the X-ray machine and so fearless with all the chemicals or the medications or whatever he would need to be doing with the animals, and he put them ahead of himself, and so he was having routine exposure. And I don't know why he got a sharp thing of cancer. I'm crushed that he did. Very, very sad that he had a really quick exit at far too young. At 56, he lived a vibrant life. He did amazing things. But he did leave us. And so our whole community is actually in grief over that one. So I'm sorry to anybody who's even hearing me put those corollaries together if they don't want those corollaries put. But you, as a vet, were using chemicals to, say, clean out bedding, and what were you using?
Well, and
in
this
general?
Is in the 70s. This is in the 70s. We're using malathion and durspan, and we're in the flea capital of the world, San Diego. All right, so the standard treatment was to dip them. So you dilute it to a safe level, whatever that is, and you pour it on them every week, the animals, and they touch them. And so I was absorbing it, but I didn't connect the dots until the doctor connected them for me. And he said, you're going to have to quit being a veterinarian. I was 34, something like that.
Young.
And I was starting to show pesticide poisoning, but I didn't even know what it was. But he figured it. He knew. He'd seen it before. So he said, you got to quit being a veterinarian or wear rubber gloves. That was his only two options. So I tried the rubber gloves. I couldn't do it. I have to touch the animals, like Scott and most veterinarians. And so I only had one other option, according to him. But then I had a third option. I prayed on it. Plus, I had everything on the line. I just started a new practice. I hawked my house. I did everything. I was on the line. So I decided what I'm going to do is tell all my clients I'm not going to use that stuff anymore, and they can't come and see me if they do, because it'll poison me. So I told them all, thinking, well, they're either going to come or they're not. And actually, it got better. More people, they didn't want to do it either. But I didn't know what else to do, because I was only trained to use chemicals, drugs, and surgery and vaccines. That's all I knew. So I started experimenting. I started studying human literature that had been around for thousands of years. They'd been doing it forever with no chemicals. So I started doing that, and that was like in the 80s, early 80s, and I quit using chemicals immediately. I went from using chemicals every day in my clinic, everything. I got rid of everything, and I quit using it. I wouldn't allow animals to come near me. So that's the problem, is if you're using these things, especially the spot on, they're transdermal. That means as soon as you put them on, they start going in the dog, and if you touch them, it goes into you. So if you're around it, and there's no studies on cumulative on any of this stuff. So if you're around it on every month, there's cumulative in the dog. They have no idea how long, and it doubles up every month. Or not doubles, but increases, and depending on your tolerance, it's neurotoxin and it's a carcinogen.
Can I say one thing, too? In fact, this just happened today. This little kitty came, a brand new little kitty that was given to these neighbors of mine. It was their cat. It came over to my house, and it came right to me as if it knew what I did and everything, and it was wearing a flea collar. And here's this little kitty with a poisonous flea collar on it, and the kids are picking it up and kissing the kitty and everything else, and that poison is going into their children.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think, you know, and that will kind of bleed into the next dialogue that we're having. We're fortunate to have Syngenta be coming in here, and I will be honest, this can't be a really easy show for them to come into, but, you know, we are exposed to chemicals left, right, and center, from what we sometimes put in our laundry detergent to what we brush our teeth with, what we put under our underarms, how we wash our hair. You know, we have a lot of chemical exposure from all kinds of ways and things. And so when we start to look at what we're getting and where we're getting it from, you know, we need to be thinking about that. I've done shows in here on cell towers and electromagnetic field, and, you know, there's just such a range of contaminants that people hold, you know, concerns and fears on. But, you know, sometimes it is the convergence of multiple things. So, you know, if somebody is, you know, insecticiding their house, or putting pesticide on their kids.
And, you know, this, what's really good, though, is that there is alternatives. We don't have to use these things or do these things. There are alternatives. They're all over the Internet. You can Google, you know, safe alternatives for flea, blah, 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 and find a great amount of information. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's the beginning of new old, going back to using things that are safe, effective, and life-giving.
And Sheila Young, you are on Facebook. Is there another website that you have or some way for people to find
Facebook
you?
No, Facebook is the best for me.
Yeah. And do you want your phone number out there? Would you rather Facebook?
Yes, whatever. Best because I don't have reception where I live, so Facebook for me is really fast and easy.
What if somebody doesn't have Facebook?
If they don't have Facebook, they can email me.
And what's your email?
It's Sheila, S-H-E-I-L-A, D-A-H-E-L-A, Sheila Dahila, at gmail.com.
Okay, Sheila Dahila at gmail.com.
Yes.
Okay. And so we're getting close towards the, you know, the wrap-up time on this. I want to make sure that you're able to be able to state what is most important to you, and let's start there, and then, you know, I have another question or two, but let's start there. What would you want people to be really able to walk away from listening to this and contemplate?
It's my dream. I've had it for a long time. And my dream is that holistic medicine no longer be the 11th hour. That's how it's been for decades.
100 years, maybe?
Well, for me, I haven't been around that long, but for decades, you know, and Igor knows it too, and any veterinarian really knows, but it does alternative medicine. They've done everything, and they're your last hope. You're the only one who can save them. And they're at 11th hour after everything's been just trashed, not purposely, but that's just what's happened. I dream of the day when we're no longer the 11th hour, that we're used as the mainstream. And then, like I said, allopathic medicine, and all of my colleagues are trained very well in that. It's mainly an emergency medicine, really. It's not really intended for prevention or anything like that.
If I get in a car accident, I want the allopaths there.
You bet.
You know,
I
mean, there's definitely a place for the emergency room.
Oh. That's mainly it, surgery and emergency.
I've always thought, for me, if we can combine the best of both worlds, mm-hmm. we would have the perfect medical system.
Yeah.
Can I give a shout out for Hawaii HMSA? I forget what that stands
for. Oh, yeah. I heard that.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
So we're holding it, our withhold.
Kaiser, I think it was.
No, this is this is HMSA. Did you hear it?
Oh, really?
No, what's that?
That they're taking homeopathic and holistic medicine practitioners now. So
yes.
That is a really, really big plus.
Yes.
So will that be covered under their insurance?
Yes.
Yeah, because I had this dream like 40 years ago. I even approached some insurance companies, and I said, you guys are missing the boat. And natural healing, they get well, it's cheaper, and you collect your same premium, and you pay out less. You're going to make more money, you know, just from the money end of it. And then if you do it, you're going to help people. And because that's the big deal, is that we have no options. We only have drugs, chemicals, and surgery. So I added a caveat to what you just asked me.
Mm-hmm.
So the caveat is that, you know, the first part is always that that time comes when holistic medicine is recognized for what it is. It's a true form of prevention and health. And the second part is because I was asked to come on here about vaccines. The thing that's happened with vaccines is we've created this myth that we can't live without vaccines or you're going to die, the sky is falling, Chicken Little. Well, I always use the same story because I hear the polio, I know all of that. I've studied it all in great deal, way beyond what anybody really knows. But the point is, it's the greatest, the worst plague in the history of the world was the Black Death, the bubonic plague of Europe during the Middle Ages.
That's when Marco Polo came back from China and brought it with him.
And it just,
and a quarter of
Europe
died.
What caused it was, the cause was man. What man did is it killed all the cats. That was the time when they were killing off the herbalists. The herbalists were being killed. And so they killed off the cats, too, because the herbalists handled the cats. What do cats do? They kill rats. The rats went wild. They carried fleas. They carried the bubonic plague, Pasteurella, pestis, and it spread. So anyway, it spread. Killed off most of Europe. The only ones that survived were the thieves. The thieves used essential oils. The essential oils prevented them from dying. So anyway, that's the story. So what happened? Was there a vaccine for it? No. There's never been vaccine for the worst plague in the history of the world, and we've never had another one. We've had a few cases here, and there are none.
Well, I do. Yeah, I have looked at this issue a lot. I will own that my kids are vaccinated, and
so are mine.
Yeah,
I didn't know any better.
Yeah, like I think if I was confronted with that now, if I had a young child now, I would be super well informed, and I would delay personally. I would delay things that I know weren't.
All six of my grandchildren are unvaccinated. Oldest is 18. The youngest is 1. They'll never be vaccinated, and they'll have to kill me before I'll let them do it.
So those are things that people need to sit there and look at. But when I have looked at it, what I have seen is something that coincided with the eradication of some of these most intensive diseases like polio and smallpox and things like that. It also happened that that's when we had sewer systems and we started doing water treatment plants. So some of them, when you look at when those water plants came out, those diseases were already going away.
There were no cases.
And there was a lot of coincidence.
By the time they got the vaccines, there weren't any significant cases anymore.
Well,
that's the history of the world.
That's what the graphing says.
I'm just saying, to listen to what I said, bubonic plague, the worst plague in the world, no vaccine, we've never had it. That's herd immunity.
Okay.
That's herd immunity.
And I'm just going to be the devil's advocate for one thing here is, like, I did have measles, mumps, rubella, chicken pox. I had all those things.
Me too.
My friends all had them. Since they've had the shots, they're not having them anymore.
Once you have it, you never get it again.
I know, but I mean, little kids aren't having it. I mean, it's like it's
not
gone.
No, it's not true.
No.
Anyway, I'm just saying where you get your information is from the manufacturer. It's called
That's
the Fox in the Hen House.
Okay. Yes, so we are just about at the end. Sheila, thank you so much. Marshall, do you have a final thought?
No.
Okay, so we are close to shifting up. I was...
May I play my flute?
Yes, please do. That'd be a great...
Thank you. This is all about mahalo and aloha.
Oh, and tell them really quickly...
Yeah.
Really quickly.
Really quickly.
What your next little foray is. I saw that you've gone on Peru, and you've done all these.
You can see it all on my
website.
I post all this stuff.
Okay, but tell what your next thing is.
I'm training for the PCT, Pacific Crest Trail. It's 2,700 miles, give or take, from Mexico to Canada. I'm going to solo walk it barefoot in sandals.
How long will that be?
I hope less than 5 months.
But you're going to solo walk it. You're not even bringing your dog.
I'm taking nothing. I'm carrying a backpack. That's it.
Okay. Well, maximum respect to you. What month of the year are you leaving to do it?
Depends on snowpack. As soon as snowpack gets right, I got to go. I hit the road.
Better than the heat of summer. Okay, we want to hear your song.
Yeah, we'll just call this Mahalo.
Okay.
Because I appreciate everybody, and I respect everyone's belief system, but it's a freedom of choice. Thank you.
Mahalo, and you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. Thank you so much, Sheila Young.
Thank you, Felicia.
Oops.
Thanks, Felicia.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Felicia.
You're welcome. Take care.
Always.
Okay, so Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man.
KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com or 639-3456.
The Kauai Historical Society presents Nā Wahine Ali'i, A Visit with Emma and Lili'u Okalani, two dramatic interpretations of the inner thoughts and personal perspectives of these noble queens. Performances will be held on Saturday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at Church of the Pacific in Princeville, and on Sunday, February 14th at 2 p.m. at St. Michael and All Angels Church Hall in Lihue. Seating is limited. Tickets available at KauaiHistoricalSociety.com and 245-3373.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please.
Declare your love on KKCR. Donate $10 or more to KKCR by Friday, February 11th, and hear your declaration of love announced on KKCR during every live show from 7 a.m. to midnight on Valentine's Day, Sunday, February 14th. More information online at kkcr.org or call 808-826-7774.
Love me too.
Aloha, listeners of KKCR. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global news hour, urging you to support Kauai Community Radio. As a beacon of free speech, KKCR has been broadcasting from their jungle shack and building community in the island since 1997. KKCR brings you Hawaiian culture and music, independent voices and choices like Democracy Now!, otherwise shut out from the corporate media. During this program, please show your love for KKCR by making an investment in the station that loves you and become a sustaining member. Your monthly support at any level will pay dividends all year long and ensure the continued success of Kauai Community Radio. From our family at Democracy Now! To your ohana in the center of the Pacific, mahalo for your support. It really does make a difference.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, I'm really happy to have two more guests in the studio right now. I'll see if I've got them mic'd up well. Joshua Uehara, do I have that right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, and Beth Tokioka.
Hello.
Great.
Good afternoon.
So, both of you are part of the management at Syngenta on Kauai. Can you, Josh, tell me what your job is exactly?
Sure, my full title is the Hawaii Continuous Nursery Site Manager. If you shorten that down, I'm basically the station manager there and in charge of our R&D operations here in Hawaii.
So is it fair to say you're the boss?
At least for the R&D guys, yep.
For the R&D guys. And then, Beth, I've probably known you 25 years, I'd say.
Yeah, that's probably about right.
Yeah, and our kids are the same age, so we actually got to do all that co-parenting phases, you know, so
right.
Soccer and school and
exactly
everything. And so most of your career on Kauai has been helping with the county, yes? County government?
Yes, correct. Mostly working in the mayor's office under three different mayors. Yeah.
So that would have been Marianne Saka, mm-hmm. Brian Baptiste, And Bernard Cavallo.
Correct. Yes.
So you know a lot.
Yeah, I've seen and heard a lot of things going on. So over the years, it was about 20 years in the mayor's office.
Yes.
And a few years with Office of Economic Development in between there.
And I'm going to ask Josh this in a minute, but where do you live?
I live in Puhi.
In Puhi. And your two kids are roughly 18 and 20 and...
Correct. Or 16 and 20, yep.
16 and 20, okay. Yeah. All right, mine are 18 and 20. So your daughter must be younger than I realized. And then, Josh, where do you live?
I live in Waimea currently, right near the bottom of the bridge.
Right near the bottom of the bridge. So you are just downwind of Pioneer.
Yep, that'd be correct. That's okay. Actually where I grew up.
You grew up. So which schools did you go to?
Well, I started out in Waimea Baptist Preschool. Then I went to Waimea Canyon Elementary School back when there was a Waimea Canyon Elementary School. Then I went to Waimea Middle School. And then I went to Waimea High School. So pretty much grew up in Waimea.
And did you go to college anywhere? Not that you had to, but did you?
Oh, yeah. I actually went to Harvard, but then I ended up dropping out.
There.
So I'm another Harvard dropout, I guess.
Okay. All right. And what did you study?
Computer science.
Computer science. And how long have you worked at Syngenta?
This year it'll be actually 10 years.
10 years. And do you have any children?
My wife and I welcomed our daughter into the world about 3 months ago. It's our first child. So.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, we're very blessed.
That's very blessed. So it would be fair to say that when we were, I'm just going to be honest with everybody that on Kauai Soapbox, there's been a lot more airtime shared with people who are nervous about your whole business and the larger agriculture. That's probably fair to say, right? Everybody's nodding their heads, but I'm just, you know, wanting to own that out there. So I really appreciate you guys coming up. And like when I started my last segment, I said what brought me to bringing them in. In that case, it was Sheila, some posts, and asking me questions relative to dogs. In this case, there was an incident that happened, and that's going to be a piece of our focus pretty soon. That was January 20th with chlorpyrifos, I believe is how you say the chemical. It's an insecticide. And so 10 workers were taken to the hospital for observation. So we will go into that in a moment. But when that did happen, I had gotten some Facebook messaging from some people I didn't really know in Hanapepe Heights, young parents from the west side who were concerned that their kids, their young teens, were showing symptoms when they sent me this video, and I sent it to you folks, of what they were seeing as the presentation of neurotoxins. And I've done something called Akamai Learning, which is an alternative middle school. So it was a double question. It was like, help, you know, we're worried. Are our kids being exposed to this? Is there this problem? And maybe we want to take them out of school, because when they look at what the ramifications are, it's, you know, dropped IQ, average 7%, a whole list of long-term health problems. So I was like, and so actually it was like 10 at night, and I contacted Beth, and I told her, and I sent something, and I asked Syngenta, would you guys be willing to come in? So I want to say thank you for saying yes to that. And I want to also acknowledge that there's been a number of presentations brought on with different scientists, and I've been really warmed to see that more people from the industry are coming to listen in the same room with the people who are concerned about the pesticides when scientists come and talk. And so what I do feel confident is that we're all a bunch of nice people who care about our community, who want the best. And so I'm glad that we are talking about this. And I think what I'm going to do, I was going to read a little piece that came out, something that's been out in the news. Maybe I will do that very quickly. I'm sure you guys know that it has been big press that ChemChina has been interested in talking with Syngenta to do a $43 billion purchase. So Here is an article that I found out of Chemistry World, so I figure this is a pretty neutral statement. And so I just want to bring this up because let's get this out of the way. To talk about that purchase seems above your pay grade. Is that fair? You know, this isn't something that you guys are really a part of.
I guess not the decision-making process, but if you do have questions, we probably can clarify some things.
Okay, well, I'm going to read this, and then we'll talk about what's happened on Kauai, and then maybe later we can talk about this piece. Or maybe there's a quick statement that you can make, and we can come back to it. But it says, not a done deal. If the deal goes ahead, the acquisition is expected to be completed by the end of the year. But that would be the end of 2016. There are several hurdles to overcome before it can be given the go-ahead. For one, at least 67% of Syngenta shareholders will need to vote to accept ChemChina's offer. The move is also facing scrutiny from the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which can take steps to block deals that are deemed a threat to the U.S. national security. While seeds and crop chemicals may not sound like national security concern, we note that this agency held up a sale of Phillips Lighting Division to Chinese investors, says Stafford. He added the U.S. has been protective of seed technology in the past, as demonstrated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation's efforts to prevent Chinese nationals leaving the U.S. with seeds. As Syngenta owns many seed-based patents, this could be a potential sticking point. Regulators in Europe are also expected to take a close look at this takeover. All things considered, Stafford says, we think there is a 50% chance to deal with close. A 50% deal, the chance the deal will close. ChemChina said, however, that it is confident the deal will receive regulatory approval. Joshua, do you have any thoughts that you would like to add to that, or something, a summary statement about what people might be expecting?
Sure. So I think, really speculating as to whether the deal may close successfully or not, that is definitely, as you put it, above my pay grade. But if we really look at, the purpose our company has for existing, it's really to help to feed the growing population in the world. I mean, we are looking at, best UN estimates are about 9.5 billion by 2050. And many of those people do live in China. So from our perspective, just looking at the prospective deal, we see this as a great way to really open a further dialogue with the Chinese government and see if what we can do to help feed their growing population as well and address some of their needs in the agricultural area. So that's what we are looking forward to as a company. We think it's a great opportunity for us to really make progress on that. But anything about the deal itself, as you put it, that's a little bit above my pay grade. So.
And then I did go to a meeting with Pioneer, maybe close to a month ago, and they were explaining to us, at least from their perspective of them sitting on about 3 years of inventory, they talked about a corn bubble, that when China first started purchasing corn, they were using it to feed chickens and pigs in China because there's an emerging middle class there that was wanting to eat proteins. But now they want to be, they already are growing their own corn. And they want to continue to grow their own corn. So at least Pioneer had upped its production level, and then they don't need to be doing so much parent seed. Is that something that's impacted Syngenta at all? Or I've heard you guys are going to be doing some other vegetables as well.
Actually, we work in many crops already. We probably have the largest vegetables portfolio. We have one of the largest vegetables businesses in the seeds area. We do cereals. We do sugar beets. We do canola. We do, you name it, we probably do something with that. So we're a very diversified ag company. And really, we just take a holistic view of the market and try to ensure that we are doing what we can to help put the technology that farmers need to help feed the growing population, put that technology into farmers' hands. So,
okay, so can you talk to us about what happened on January 20th with chlorpyrifos, which is an insecticide? And I did bother to look up and have the label and both of the labels. It's called Lorsban, and then I have Lorsban. I've got to pull it up again. I'll grab it in a minute. But I have those, and I also have the good neighbor policy with the different spray records, so that when the people are listening, know that I am looking at stuff that can back up what they're talking about.
Sure, we can go into that. I mean, did you want me to go into some?
I'd like to start with what happened on January 20th, and
okay.
to explain that, and if that's comfortable for you.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what we're here to talk about.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Mm. Sure. So on January 20th in the morning, basically we had a number of employees who went into the field and accidentally actually walked across a number of fields and ventured into a field that they weren't supposed to be in. Now, a field supervisor on site noticed the situation within a few minutes. And so at that point, the field supervisor just sort of followed our protocols and said, okay, we're going to take people back to the station. We're going to get them cleaned up. We're going to see if any of those employees want to seek any kind of medical assessment. And those who are interested, we're going to take them to get that assessment. So that's really, in a nutshell, what transpired on the morning of the 20th. I can say further, you know, through the rest of that day, 7 out of the 10 people who went to the hospital were released after observation, and 3 more were released the following morning after observation. One thing I can share now that we hadn't been able to share previously was we actually had an after-action review with the hospital just to assess, you know, how are things handled? Is there a way we can handle these things better in the future? Through that meeting, we did learn that basically, from the doctor's perspective, all of the actions they took were purely precautionary. What they do is they follow protocols as laid out to them by state poison control and other agencies that they consult with. And so they basically held people for observation as a precautionary measure. And everyone was back to work, thankfully, the following Monday.
So, and if your field supervisor wants to call in, they're welcome to call in, I'm hoping, and going to actually block calls for a little while from other callers because I want to actually get to some of the details of this. And so, like, how many of those workers were your long-term workers? I'm wondering why this problem happened.
Sure. Actually, of the 10 people that went to the hospital, they were temporary seasonal workers for us.
And where are they from?
A
do
number
they
of them
here or do
from
they live
here, from the West Coast, kind of a mix.
Okay, and then so I'm looking at this list of questions because it's right in front of me that was sent to me, and I also was looking at the Lord's Band Advanced Label to be working with this. Were there signs posted around the perimeter of the fields that listed the material?
Yes. So according to the requirements, the Worker Protection Standard requirements called WPS, we actually post on a central notification board. That's what the requirement is. But we also, above and beyond that requirement, do put a sign at the front of the field where we do post information regarding what products may have been applied most recently and at what point it's safe to re-enter the field.
Okay, and I believe I've got your field manager on here. Is this you? Aloha. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for calling in. You work at Syngenta?
Yes.
And you were there that day?
Yes.
Okay, can you tell us what happened, and I might be able to ask you some of these questions. Would you like to add anything to what Joshua has shared, or?
Pretty sure Josh covered it pretty well.
Okay, so when we have 9 of the 10 workers aren't permanent employees, do you have any idea why those workers failed to see them? Do they speak English? Is it an issue about English? I mean, I've seen the signs before, and typically they have the re-entry interval written right on them.
Yes, it's just they haven't been following the right protocols and walking across the field instead of to the front of the field and entering at the sign.
So it was because they just... Oh, do you have something to say, Beth? Okay. So it was the angle in which that they walked over. So you have to be very, very careful with it.
Yes.
And so you saw it. You pulled them out. You put them in the van. And what was the reason that you put them in the van to take them to the medical center?
Well, we put them in the van just to get them transferred over. But as it happened... I asked a few of them that who was in the section, and they said, yeah, that they were in that section, and I told them that if they knew that the field that they entered that the REI did not expire. And they said, oh, no, that we didn't walk in that section. So as a precaution, I just took everyone in that van and brought them over, got them deconned.
Deconned, what does that mean?
You go in, you take a hot shower, you get cleaned up, wash up really well, and put on a suit where you can sit because all your clothes are contaminated.
So was this Lord's van that you were working with?
Yes.
And which is chlorpyrifos, correct?
Yes.
And then this question can really be for either you or Josh. Like, I'm looking at this label. I believe it is 18 pages long. So I will be honest, it's a little over my head. It's not real simple, but I'm looking at where it has worker restricted entry intervals. So I see it's different for Christmas trees, citrus fruits, broccoli. You know, it really depends upon what kind of crop is in there. I see asparagus, it's 24 hours, whereas if it was apple trees, it's 4 days. Citrus fruit, it's 5 days. So I think to myself, 5 days, that's serious, right? Why does something take 5 days? Is that because of the wind or...
Well, that's something I can probably speak to.
Yeah, that is something probably for Josh.
Okay, and then I can come back to questions for either of you. So, Josh, what would be your reaction to why would something need 5 days, and how would you know? Is it a different amount of chemical, or is it the airflow?
So a lot of what happens really when companies are looking at a label like this is they try to build in a very large safety buffer. Sometimes we're talking about 10x. Sometimes we're talking about some of our products we build in a 1,000x safety buffer.
That means 1,000 times what is tested as problematic.
Well, not even tested as problematic, just tested at this is the level that EPA would otherwise require, and then we build in a safety buffer beyond that.
So EPA is the Environmental Protection Agency. Okay.
Yep. So when you look at different crops, I mean, the difference is there. I think in a golf course, it's actually as soon as the grass is dry. So what you're really looking at is, What is the situation in which people will be in the field and what will they likely be doing? So I can't speak to this product in particular. It's not one of ours, but I'd imagine, in some cases you'd look at, are people going to be picking up fruit and handling it for a long time, in which case that's different than if you're just walking across a golf course. So that can lead to some of the differences in the use instructions, and one of those instructions might be the REI.
Okay, and then something that this Akamai listener had sent me. Here's a word that's new for me. It's called cholinesterase. Do you know that word?
Cholinesterase, yep.
Okay, say that one more time.
Cholinesterase.
Okay, so there is that activity level that usually indicates excessive absorption of organophosphate compounds into the bloodstream. And so... Syngenta, with their long-term, like the spray applicators, they do those blood testing, right?
Yes.
And is your name Colin, is that correct? Manager?
Hi. Sorry.
So your workers, do they have follow-up blood testing and medical treatment, or when there is a sense that there is exposure? Do they test for this? Cholinesterase. Is that part of your job to see if that happens?
No, that is not part of my job.
Okay, so let me see. These might be most of the questions that would have been there for you. It sounds like what happened is you had some relatively short-term employees who forgot while they're walking of what is the right protocol, and they went into the field from the wrong angle. Is that correct? That was the main problem?
That is correct.
And so you took action based on your training, based on the protocol of the company, and immediately took them, whether they were showing symptoms or not, to the hospital?
Yes.
Was anybody showing symptoms?
Some were like itchy and headache, but I'm pretty sure, like what Josh was saying, that a lot of it could have been caused from dehydration and so forth.
But so when people are itchy, immediately they go into the showers?
Oh, not necessarily. Okay. If they're itchy, because anybody can be allergic to anything, and some people are allergic to just brushing up against a corn plant or any plant in particular.
But it wouldn't typically be a good job for people who are allergic to corn, right?
Probably not.
Although, interestingly enough, we actually do have a number of employees that just take some allergy meds, and otherwise they enjoy their job. So.
Right, right.
Yes.
I have been to Dow's facility, and they have shower and safety stations all over the place, and they actually have medics, or a medic, that typically is in the field with the part-time workers that are there. At least that when we did a several-hour field trip, and they were showing us that. Okay, so I appreciate your calling in. Is there anything in particular that you would really like for people to know what you might have seen as the field supervisor who made the choice to take everybody to get checked out?
I really just wanted to make sure that they were all okay, and that with one unsure, clear answer, I just wanted to take on necessary precaution and get everybody. So.
Well, I want to honor you for doing that. That's one thing that I really have some concern here, is that when somebody made a right choice, that there isn't a big backlash. I know that, this went like a flash across social media, and everybody are noticed, because the neighborhood and the islands are nervous about this type of thing happening. But it's good that you took direct action. Are all 10 of them still working?
Yes.
And so people aren't, at least in the month's time, it hasn't been a month, but a few weeks, nobody's come down ill or needed to quit?
No, not at all.
Okay, so thank you so much for calling in, and I think I can leave Joshua in the hot seat there. We appreciate your participation, and you feel confident when you go to work every day, and your people, like I went and took the training. I took the sprayer training. And so I learned about how you put your clothes in two different washing machines. Is that correct? You know, you have two washer
yes.
and dryers, and so that's something that people typically do in their home. They have two
yes.
sets of washers.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right. I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
So there's one thing I'd just like to kind of back up, because I do agree with what you said, Felicia, earlier, that, you know, our first priority really is the safety of our people. That's the number one concern we have. And as Cullen demonstrated, you know, with his actions and the actions of his colleagues at the time, that's all that we're thinking about. You know, what if there's a backlash after that? That totally doesn't even occur to us at that point. This is really looking out for the safety of our colleagues, and if we're at all unsure, we just take the maximum precaution. And so that's really what occurred that day, and I'd really like to commend Cullen and his colleagues for that. So,
And I want to commend them for that, too. I think it's really important, and for us here at KKCR, it's really important that we don't amplify something that isn't correct. I did see on Facebook assertions that people were in intensive care and things like that, and when that's inaccurate, we want to make sure that that is not what is spread. So all of them went back to work. Now, I'm still looking at this piece from this person who actually works deeply in farming. It says, we know that the applicators who apply from the large spray rigs are routinely blood tested for cholinesterase. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Does Syngenta also offer this same program to its field workers?
No, I mean, if we do suspect that there might be an issue, that's something we would definitely consider. But that's not something routine, and that's really based on safe use according to the label. So we just follow EPA guidelines, and the EPA has stated this product is safe if used in accordance with the label. The Hawaii Department of Agriculture has reviewed the product, as has Hawaii Department of Health, and recently actually the National Association of State Departments of Ag, which represents the state departments of ag of all 50 states, also wrote a letter really endorsing, you know, the safety and the importance of the product. So,
well, I don't want to be arguing with you all here, but I do know that
chlorpyrifos.
Chlorpyrifos. I've practiced that in the background. Chlorpyrifos actually is, it has been taken out of home use. It is under consideration for being removed from safe use. When I look at this label here, I see that there are different states that it's not allowed to be used in. There are different states that have, like even right here where I was looking at the citrus, it says not for use in Mississippi. There's different places along the label that say which states have removed it. So I don't think that it's really a fair statement to say that there's no reason to be concerned. You know, the label says one thing, and so the label and the Environmental Protection Agency is telling us that this is something that works well. Another document that I did send to both of you was another piece that had been sent to me where it highlighted, and I'm pulling that up here, but it highlighted two other, one is called Tilt and one is called Evic, I believe, two other pesticides that's used by Syngenta, and that there is a different label for Hawaii that has lowered standards and ability to use it in higher winds than is what the national EPA label is. So we see that Hawaii can relax standards on what is set at the national level. So that's another area where people have concerns. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I know that's just something that every company works with the state departments of ag, whether it's any individual state or at the federal level with the EPA, to understand, you know, what are the realistic scenarios for use and what use patterns might be safe in a given crop in a given area. And that's the label coming from that is really the result of that discussion back and forth between the company and the Department of Ag or the EPA.
So I'm trying to work with you to help me build confidence in the people out there. Last show I had, we had some people in here who were talking about the new dairy. And you are listening, by the way, to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia with the Kauai Soapbox. We have managers from Syngenta, or main manager, Joshua Uehara, and then Beth Tokioko. Your title one more time?
Community Outreach Manager.
Community Outreach Manager. So last week, the listeners were hearing us look at what Department of Ag had, Scott Enright had basically stated to the community relative to manure use at Mahalulipu, relative to the dairy, and that there wasn't impacts and that this was a straight go-ahead. And then there's been a very powerful letter, without going into detail, of the many places where there has been violation of what really should be state ag possibilities. And what we do know there is that the stream there has had a toxicity level of fecal coliforms in there. The bacterial count has been some months like 17,000 when healthy is below 100. So in our last conversation, the Department of Ag has really come into strong question of whether that they're, you know, like, they're still trying to resolve that. Like, why are they supporting something when the Department of Health and everything else, it's clearly beyond their standards. So we have a confidence issue with the Department of Ag. So the community has that. So I'm trying to look at how do we feel better. So some of the hard questions that people have put out, there has been a report came out in France, some researchers in France. Now, I can't speak French. I read the summary of it. I haven't seen the hair follicle samples, but two kids in Kekaha had hair samples taken. They had 35 pesticide, more than 35 pesticides, where it had happened in Europe, over 100 pesticides were in their hair samples. And we have what had come out before in the ambient air quality tests in Waimea Canyon Middle School, there has been chlorpyrifos and others in that school. So how do you speak to the parent who is afraid? That's who got brought me in here, and those are who are listening too. I'm sure many people are listening, but I'm following up on them saying, we're worried. I know what they would like. They would like to know that chlorpyrifos wouldn't be one of these pesticides that's continued to being used. I mean, I know that there's a whole lot of other different opportunities to deal with insects. How likely is that, that could be stopped? Or what would you say to those parents beyond the label?
Sure. And actually, I think you bring up a couple of good points regarding confidence, and I'll get to that in a moment. But the first thing I'd say to a parent, and I think I can speak for the entire West Side community, whether with our company, our industry, or just in general on the West Side, parents are going to be concerned about their children for a number of reasons. What I would encourage parents to do if they are concerned is contact the Department of Health. Go see a doctor. See if you can assess what the situation really is, because whether or not it has anything to do with our operations or otherwise, the most important thing to do is to find out what's actually going on. So if there is a report out there, and I think I did see that you sent it to us, I think it was earlier today.
Yesterday.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't had a chance to actually read through it in any detail, but what I would say is if that is the case, and two children from the West Side were referenced in that report, I would strongly encourage their parents to go and seek the proper assessment and see what's actually happening.
Well, that parent has been persistent at this for 2 to 3 years and is very, very concerned. And she lives in the Hawaiian homelands in Kekaha, in those houses, in the Hawaiian home housing. And, she's very, very concerned, and she has been looking at this. I see the six kids, they were from Cutler Orosi, California, and I don't know where that is, but that had over 100. Now, something, I don't know if you heard our earlier show, the earlier part of the show where we were talking about different pesticides and even what's there in the flea collars and how we're all pretty unconscious of how many different places. Even I'm told, like, receipts that you get when you get your gas or the cash register receipts, supposedly that has toxicity in it. So many different things that we have carcinogens, and they have toxicity. Something that I would like to do, and I was talking with the mother in this place, she said it was about a $250 test, but I'd be willing to test that. My hair, or my kid's hair, it would be nice to be able to see. Taking tests, we live on the North Shore. We have a lot of cancer deaths up here. We have all kinds of chronic health problems. We have birth defects. We have all kinds of things. I don't know if that's legacy chemical. I'm not sure what it is. But it would be very, very interesting to see a comparative from the different areas and start to really look. Because I think that what the outcry is something is wrong. And so what I got as a really strong response when I said that, we were going to have this discussion, people say, well, yeah, good for those employees, because they have an employer who cares about them, takes immediate action, takes them to the doctor, and they know what is happening. So when we have this good neighbor program, and I know there's another bill before the legislature, even just either today or tomorrow, trying to make that mandatory across the islands, does the hospital, like at KVMH or Wilcox and Lihue, are they on your good neighbor program? Do they know what your spraying, your active spraying is?
Actually, yes. So we actually had meetings with the hospital prior to this. So we met with the hospital, I think.
Prior to the show or prior to the incident?
Prior to the incident. So
okay.
We actually sat down with the hospital administrator, some of their staff, and said, hey, we want you to know what we're doing because you're a neighbor to our operation. We also want you to know what we're doing because you're potentially a service provider that we'll rely on as part of the community, and you're an important part of the community for us. So we wanted to ensure that they understood that what we were doing, that we understood if they had any needs of us. So that's a meeting that we had. I think it was probably about 6 months ago at this point. And we continue to have those kinds of meetings with the hospital and those kinds of discussions.
How about the regular doctor providers there, just the clinics and the where people might go, what the parents were worried about? And then I'm going to open it up for calls pretty soon at 826-7771. The parents were concerned that when their kids have, like, they watch this video, and so one of the things was nausea and diarrhea, it can be headaches, and that their kids come home from school sometimes and they have this and the rest of the family doesn't get sick. They think, well, is that what it is? There's a lot of fear that's there. They don't know. And so many of these, if you just have low-grade exposure, it's not going to be something very profound. So people don't know how to tell the difference. Is there anything that you look for amongst your employees or amongst your people where you would be on the lookout for something that looks like chronic exposure, perhaps, to low-grade poisoning?
Well, I think what I'd want to reiterate is that for us, safety really is the first priority for our employees. So if we were to have a concern, we definitely would have a discussion with them. Now, that being said, we're not medical professionals, so we can't really assess those kinds of things within our employee with all of our colleagues, you know, directly. So what we do is we encourage them, you know, whether you feel anything or not, if you are concerned, let us know and we'll take you. And we did actually have follow-up discussions with the hospital, and we said, if any of your providers, any of your staff, even if they're not directly involved in medical care, if they just have questions about what we do, or if they have questions about what might be happening if we were to bring employees in for assessment, please let us know, and we'd be more than willing to go to the hospital and have a discussion with them about here's what we do.
So what if the listener right now is concerned about how their kids are feeling? What would you say to them? You're just telling them to go to the doctor. What if they don't have – I mean, I have health insurance, but I have to pay – my deductible is $600. It's like crazy expensive. So I don't just go to the doctor if I have a sniffle or I don't feel very well. I mean, what would they be looking for? Or if they go in, can they look at their – cholinesterase? Can they go in and have this cholinesterase test done? Is that standard procedure if somebody comes in and they say, I'm vomiting, I have diarrhea and a headache, can you look at my cholinesterase levels, activity levels? And so if it's depleted, would they be able to think that maybe they have organophosphate compounds in themselves? I mean, people are truly asking this. They've been crying about it for years.
Sure, sure. That definitely is a standard kind of blood test that you can take. Now, what a physician would
do... Do you have to ask for it, or do you think the doctors would say, where do you live? You live in Kekaha. You go to school at Waimea School. Let's look. This was sprayed today. Would that be standard protocol?
Yeah, so it is standard protocol for doctors to do is really assess, and they will ask you questions. And this is where when you talk to a doctor and they ask you, how are you feeling? What have you done? Do you have any idea why you think you feel the way you do? What they're really trying to do is assess what should they be looking for. They're trying to understand because there are hundreds of tests that they can run. There are hundreds of diagnostic procedures they can possibly bring to bear. So it's kind of a detective work for them, and they're just trying to assess what should they be looking for? Because they can't test everything, so they have to figure out what they think is more than likely and what they think they need to do in that case.
But can they look right at your spray records and the spray records? Can they look and people can go into this? This is a very robust, the Good Neighbor program. It doesn't have glyphosate, and I'll say lots of other people besides these companies use glyphosate. They're used all over the place. It's moving down. But can they go in? Because I have people call in, cry in, nurses call in, and they say, I've gone, I've asked, and they won't tell me this. They get sent home that it's a flu. I mean, this has been over the past couple of years. It hasn't been in the past couple of weeks, but... I've been to almost all of those meetings that went out over the 2491, and I've flown over to Oahu to listen. And so a pretty consistent cry that I believe that I'm hearing, I mean, I know that I'm hearing it, is people don't feel like they get the right thing from medical. Okay, we have a caller, and I'm sure that they will be nice and respectful. Aloha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Aloha. Thank you, Felicia. And aloha, Beth and Josh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, aloha.
Thanks you know, for I have a question, and the question is, I've worked in large scale agriculture for some years now, and I'll say that our particular farms have actually had lots of residual chemical residues in the soils. And my question that I like to ask you guys is, if there was actual documentation that there was Syngenta-made chemicals in fields in Kauai, would Syngenta be willing to work on cleaning it up with other plants, mycelium, and microorganisms?
Do you understand the question? There is definitely methodology for bioremediating the fields. It's you know, when we hear it's, you know, $1 million an acre, you know, these really phenomenal amounts. I mean, I might be exaggerating, but there's staggering amounts to bioremediate or to basically scrape it up and move it away. You can do bioremediation. So he's asking, would Syngenta take an interest in working with people who have the, is this correct? Tell me, would they be interested in working with or helping with the bioremediation of fields that are holding Syngenta-branded chemicals in it? Is that correct, caller?
Yes.
So I think I can take a step back, really, and answer that from a more general perspective. So one of the things that our company has done is we've made 6 very specific commitments to the global community in what we call our Good Growth Plan. Now, speaking to the question here, one of those specific commitments is really to what we call rescue farmland that's on the brink of degradation, whether that's due to desertification or whether that was due to past activities that occurred on the farmland that rendered it marginal. It's a very specific commitment that we've made that will improve the fertility on 10 million hectares of farmland over the next few years. And that's something we measure and that's something we report on. We actually report that data through the Open Data Institute. So what I would say is we are looking at all options on the table. We feel that rescuing farmland and ensuring that it stays fertile is really a priority in order to help feed the growing population of the world. So I can't speak specifically to this particular issue, but I can say I'm willing to listen, certainly. So if you do have something you'd wish to talk to us about, and actually in more general terms, if anybody is concerned about what we do, or has questions for us or would like to discuss opportunities like this for us or with us, feel free to give us a call and come visit us out in Kekaha.
So they could come and speak to you about the technology that they have and you would listen.
Absolutely.
Okay, Josh, I really do appreciate that. If Felicia can actually pass you my number, I will give you a call tomorrow.
Sure.
And, I appreciate that. I understand that you guys are providing jobs for people. I really respect you guys that you guys came on the air right here. And as someone who's worked in Big Ag, it's the only major industry in the world that usually doesn't have industrial cleanup plans behind it, but it's very needed.
Well I think, and really to speak to that, I mean, from our perspective, if I can throw out some information here, I mean, what we understand and looking at the best data that we have available and working with stakeholders across the globe, over the next few decades, we're going to have to produce more food for people than has been produced in all of human history leading up to today. So the problem for us, as we see it as a global community, is we really just can't afford for farmland to degrade because there's no more farmland to be had. I mean, really, when we look at things, you look at clearing of the rainforest, et cetera. Those are the kinds of things that would need to be done, which we can't afford as a global community either. So what we're looking at is, how do you preserve the farmland we have? How do you enhance it? Because it's not even the case that we can afford to continue production at current levels. We're going to have, by the time I retire, there will be twice as many people on this planet versus the day I was born. So we have to figure out how do we make do with what we've got and, in fact, make more of what we have. That's just the situation we're in as a global community.
That begs the question, how old are you? You look young.
I was born in 83, so I'm 32.
32, okay. Because I'm jumping in here, caller, permaculture is another way. There are plenty of ways of creating food, and so sometimes what's a little difficult to listen to, I know that some of the organic words are hard for conventional farming to listen to, but for people who are into permaculture and in organic, it's hard to hear that we can't provide the food. There's a lot of food that can be produced in other methodology, but it's worker intensive. And so what's really needed is to allow people to live on the land. If you can't live on the land, you can't produce the food. You guys can produce the food because you've got these big machines. You know, to produce it in a regenerative way, it takes a warm, close relationship between the humans and the land, and it causes people to go back to being working the land. It used to be, you know, the majority of people worked on the farm. Now, something like less than 2% do. We have to shift if we want to move away from what has become large agriculture, but that's a piece. Caller? Thank you
yes.
for letting me jump in you. I have another caller who would like to go on
the
air.
Thank you so much.
And I'll
thank
give him
you.
Your number.
Thank you.
Okay. Aloha. Thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Aloha. Good job, Felicia. Yeah, I just have a quick question. I'm wondering if Syngenta has any plans, and forgive me if you've already talked about this because I missed it, but if Syngenta has any plans of disclosing their glyphosate usage.
Oh, like on the Good Neighbor program, like in that same way. Are you
in
guys?
That same way?
Yes.
That would be acceptable. Yes. I'm just wondering if they have any plans of doing that.
We currently do not have any plans to do that, but what we are doing is working with the Hawaii State Department of Agriculture to try to really work with the community, understand the concerns, and address them, you know, not only as our company, but also as a larger industry. So that is something that we are working on. We're actually looking at that program potentially going statewide, not just here on Kauai, because of some
can
of those
I ask,
concerns.
May I ask, and thank you for your explanation, may I ask why you do not, I mean, you disclose the atrazine that you use, you disclose the other pesticides, the 2,4-D that you use in the Good Neighbor program. Why do you not disclose glyphosate usage?
I think Felicia actually touched on an important point earlier, and that is the fact that our industry, in fact, is not the only industry that uses glyphosate.
Absolutely, I agree, 100%.
And yeah. And just giving a little background, because I recognize the voice of the caller, this
thank
person
you.
Happens to be the person who did or helped do the bee tests around the island and was finding glyphosate in bees all over the place, but with a heavy concentration in the Kawakami area and much heavier on that area where
on that side,
on
yes.
that side, even though you did find it, alarmed all of us because the organic people, everybody's
found it many places.
Found
yes,
it many
it
places.
Was strongest on that west side area.
So, and caller, I believe that there is legislation before the Congress, or I mean, before our legislature this season, asking for that. So you need
We're,
to follow
let's
that.
Hope so. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I have another.
Thank you.
I have
Aloha.
Another caller. Aloha. Aloha. Thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Felicia.
Yes.
This is Bridget Hammerquist, and I just wanted to call in and ask. I don't know. I missed the first part of your show, but has anyone covered the fact that part of the difficulty and the need for using more herbicides and pesticides is when you monocrop versus when you have multiple crops? And I wanted to ask your guest if they've done any research and how much more they have to use because monocropping versus having multiple crops, such as is described by the United Nations in their study, Farming at a Crossroads.
Thank you for that question. We were just starting to talk about that as I was giving my plugs for permaculture and diversified ag. I know BASF and Dow has come on a field trip with us. And then Pioneer said that they were willing to, and maybe Syngenta would like to come and learn some from the permaculturists and the regenerative agriculture community. Is that something that would be interesting to you?
Yeah, I mean, all of agriculture is interesting to me. That's where I grew up, and I'm always learning new things, and I'm definitely willing to come out and take a look. We'll have to figure out when that can happen. We'll probably get into some of our background here toward the end of the call, or towards the end of the show, I'm guessing.
And we're almost there. We're going to have a jazz show at the top of the hour. It looks like Cousin Rich is in here for Jazz with John. Caller, I appreciate that you're bringing that up, and then we will definitely be following on that because she is bringing up a very big divide in how people look at agriculture. If people need machines, you need a lot more land. If you use people, you need a lot more people. It might be argued that people don't want to do that work, but what we need to do is be allowing people to live on the land.
And I think maybe on that point, what I'd like to interject here, and Felicia, I'll leave with you some documents regarding what I mentioned earlier, which is the Good Growth Plan. And one of the specific commitments we've made there as well is to improve the yield versus inputs. Now, that would be land, water, fertilizer, whatever pesticides may need to be used. We want to improve the efficacy and efficiency of that by at least 20%. That is a measurable commitment that we've made. So we are trying to figure out how do you reduce the inputs required, because as I said, what we have to figure out as a global community is how do we grow food, more food, with using less resources.
And I would like to introduce you sometime in the future to this caller, Bridget, who was my guest last week. And what a powerhouse of capability, knowledge, law, and health. Bridget, are you down with that, meeting these guys?
Sure, I'm very much down with that. And Felicia, I would just like to offer that my brother's a horticulturalist and has studied it all his life. And he's kind of the one that taught me that with diversification, you can have big areas even, massive areas, and you don't, as long as you have the diversification, you don't have near the pest difficulties that you do with monocropping. And I think that there are any number of sustainable farmers on Kauai that have had that experience as well, that don't need to use any glyphosates, they don't need to use any pesticides, and they are able to raise crops successfully with high yields on small areas. So it's just something that I've kind of wondered why the large companies aren't looking at, because I know they know they're leaving chemicals behind. They are contaminating, you know, the soil, the air at times when they're spraying, and then the water from the runoff.
So the exciting thing is we've got a lot of opportunity to, you know, grow food in a good direction, and so we're going to work with everybody. And Bridget, was your brother born here also like you and raised in the islands as well?
Yes.
So you're back, you're a Waimea girl just like Josh is.
Kamakani, actually.
Kamakani.
Yeah, close.
Okay. All right, close. Yeah. Okay, and I guess the one other thing today, what is before the legislature was doing, is kind of like the 2491 of the state, although it will probably be morphed big today, but there was a piece of buffer zone, putting buffer zones around the schools that would basically have this bioremediating quality. So thank you, Bridget. I have time for my last caller.
Thanks for your time. Okay,
okay, aloha.
Aloha.
Thank you, caller. You're my last caller. Pose your question quick.
Thank you, Felicia. Thank you for the program, and thanks to Josh and Beth for coming all that way over. And I just had a few questions specifically about, get back onto the chlorpyrifos question. I'm very curious, you know, I look at the Good Neighbor program quite frequently to see, you know, what different formulations, and I'm curious, what exactly are the uses you have for chlorpyrifos, and how many times in a growing season do you find the need to use that, and what are your target insects? Do you do a pre-emergent spray, or, you know, and how much, if you know, per acre, or you, do you need to apply a chlorpyrifos to grow out a crop of corn?
Sure. So maybe this actually is a good time to take a step back and talk about what we call integrated pest management. And really what that is we do take a look at, you know, what are the different approaches we can take to address pests, whether they're insects and weeds. Now, to answer your question very briefly, we use chlorpyrifos. It's an insecticide, so it's really to address some of the insect pests that are in the field. And we use that post-emergence, so it's when the corn crop has already emerged from the ground. And if we see certain pests attacking the crop, that's when we'll use it. But in the context of integrated pest management, what we do is we look at what are all of the options available. So to answer your question, we use chlorpyrifos when we feel that it is the best option. So it's not necessarily the case that it'll always be used on any given crop or that we have a standard number of times. It's something that we use when we feel that that is the best tool in the toolbox, so to speak. You know, looking at another situation, let's say with respect to weeds, weeds in the field, they're very difficult to address once you have a crop. I'm sure many farmers that are listening to the radio station right now can attest, you know, once you have the crop in the ground and it's growing and weeds grow up among your crop, pulling that out is difficult to do without damaging your crop. Cutting it without accidentally cutting your crop is actually very difficult. The best way to address weeds is to make sure the seeds aren't in the ground when you put the crop in the ground in the first place. And the best way to ensure the seeds aren't in the ground when you have a crop is to ensure the weeds aren't there prior to your having a crop in the ground. And in an environment like Hawaii, where things grow year-round, the best way to ensure that weeds aren't in your field prior to the crop is to actually grow something else, like a cover crop or an alternate crop. And that's really an example of a way we use integrated pest management, in this case for weeds. Really, we look at what is the best option to control weeds, and that's sort of the chain of logic.
That's really great to know you guys use that. I'm just curious, do you folks ever do any sort of testing for your soil web, you know, how much microorganisms are in there? Because a lot of these things, the herbicides, et cetera, they kill all the flora and fauna in the soil as well.
We do actually regular soil health tests where we look at, you know, just like any other farmer, because that's really what we're doing here. We're trying to figure out how do we get the best, most reliable yields out of the crops that we grow. We monitor soil health. We're doing sampling on tissue samples from the plants themselves to see, you know, based on what's in the soil, what's actually getting into the plant, and is the plant getting sufficient nutrition in the right amounts? And just to understand also, on the islands here, we get a lot of visitors actually from the Midwest, and they're very surprised when we take them on tours around our farm, which, as I mentioned earlier, anyone who's interested, please contact us if you want a tour. But when you go around the farms...
I want one.
Oh, you're welcome to come out, Felicia. But, you know, when you are looking at the farms here in the islands, one thing that really surprises farmers from the Midwest, for example, is that we have a incredible variety of different kinds of soils. Out on the Mana Plain, we have very silty loams. We have very sandy soils. We have very heavy marine clay areas. And the variety of soil that you have to work with as a farmer is just astounding. So that's something that we actually do keep a very close eye on, and we actually sample to take a look at our soil health and what we need to do then based on that to have a healthy crop.
That's great information, and I think one of the reasons that chlorpyrifos is banned in California in the coastal areas is on the use of corn, because it does absorb through all those sandy soils. So that's one of the bans on one of the formulations for chlorpyrifos. It's not used on corn in California and coastal areas.
Thank you, caller, and we are at the top of the hour. Okay, aloha. You are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, and Cousin Rich with Jazz with John is showing us a little aloha. He's going to let this very last caller who really wants to come through and I'm going to let you each give, once the caller's done, I'm just asking you from my heart to be speaking to those parents in your closing statement, you know, that to help them understand what's there. Okay, final call, and we're beyond time. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha, Felicia. Hey, Joshua. This is Clayton Kubo.
Hey, Clayton.
Waimea, Kauai. I would like to invite you to a meeting. I know you know about them already. It was said, yeah? So I'm putting out my hand toward you and Syngenta. And I'd like to thank you for expressing your interest, yeah, in dialoguing, yeah? Because basically, if we cut off dialogue, then there is no solutions yet to this problem. Okay, like I said again, I'd like to invite you. I'm gonna get noticed. Yeah, thank you very much for your time. Yeah, Felicia.
Okay, thank you.
Before you
That's
drop
all
off,
I have
Clayton.
To say, Josh. Okay.
Before you,
you
drop
know where
off.
I live. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I do, or my parents certainly do.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. Your father does. So.
Yeah.
Okay, Joshua. Like I said, yeah. Thank you very much for having dialogue, man.
Oh, no problem. That's exactly why we're here. Before you do drop off, though, I'm actually not certain that I do know about the meeting that you're talking about.
Are you saying, caller, Clayton, are you saying you would like to call together a meeting for them to speak with people in the community?
Oh, most definitely.
So that's what he's saying.
He would like... That is on this island.
Yes, he would
in
like...
In one room, okay. answering serious questions, just like how we had... January 14th, yeah, with
Pioneer
Richard McCormick and
Laurie Yoshida.
What's that, Felicia?
Laurie Yoshida.
Yeah, but, you know, that's all it is, just, you know, like I said before, if we cut off dialogue, then there is no solution to this problem.
Okay, and I'll talk to him after the show about that, because I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Mahalo.
Thank you.
Okay, mahalo.
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha. Okay, quick minute out of you. And then we'll be out of here because the jazz program will be on. We've had listeners, by the way, around the country, less around the world than normal, but around the country and certainly around the islands. So, Joshua, thank you for coming in. A final thought?
I think what I'd like to say, and I think Clayton sort of touched on that very well, is, you know, we do have to keep an open dialogue. And if people are concerned, I do encourage them to please reach out to us. Also, if they have concerns, please let people know. Please, if you're concerned about your health, the health of the West Side, talk to the Department of Health. If you get nowhere with them, give us a call, and we'll see what we can do to help
address
that.
What number should they call?
Our station number is 338-140 or 337-1408.
337-1408. Okay, and then because Department of Health, so that's a really tough one to get a deep response. But thank you so much for that outreach, Beth.
Well, I guess Felicia, I think you had mentioned speaking to the moms out there, and as we mentioned earlier, we're both moms.
Yes.
And of course, if you ever feel something is impacting the health of your child, that's going to be